Blog Talk Radio.
Outside here in California, it's a sunny day. I hope it's good weather where you're at. I hear from friends on the East Coast that the weather is warming up, and snow is stopping in many areas, and rain's coming down. At least people that I know in Virginia and the Carolinas. Hopefully it's comfortable enough for you to get out a little bit. As we are now celebrating spring, I'm a huge hiker. I get out in a couple of days a week. I get around the local area. I'm close to a reserve, an area in Northern California on the east side, across from San Francisco, an area called the Wildcat Canyon Hiking Reserve. It's actually a park, and it allows me to get out quite regularly and get a little exercise. Not one for the gym at all. I prefer to get outside and stretch my legs and breathe in the air. I just find that a really great kind of an exercise rather than pushing weights and stuff like that, but that's just me. So anyhow, lots going on, as usual. I always suggest people go to the Facebook page. What's interesting right now, and you all know I have a big interest on Mars, and have been posting information on Mars now since the inception of Earth Ancients. Dr. John Brandenburg, who's a nuclear physicist, wrote a book a few years ago. And what he believes is evidence of nuclear catastrophes on the surface of Mars. And he recently submitted a paper to a scientific inquiry that really reveals that there was, and there's evidence of nuclear bomb detonation on a couple of different areas of Cydonia. And apparently, and I haven't read this paper yet, we're going to have Dr. Brandenburg on the program in April, the second week of April, so stay tuned for that. But apparently this paper reveals compelling evidence of destruction of what he calls buildings that were destroyed, surface features that indicate detonation of a nuclear device, a number of nuclear devices. And I only had a chance to kind of glance through the paper, but it reveals, and this is scientific, this is a physicist, she's a practicing physicist, so it's not somebody just randomly talking about an event that happened. He actually provides evidence based on the information that we have delivered to us by satellites that are circling the planet, by apparently some soil samples. And so this is not just speculation. This is actually actual evidence that there was a bomb, a number, and gets into the potential of an alien group who were the ones who caused this destruction. So anyhow, we'll learn more about that. But take a look at that article. It is on the Facebook page. You see a picture of the two explosions where they were detonated, and you can see he actually shows where the rover, the Opportunity rover, and the Curiosity rover are parked, and he speculates that NASA may be focusing the rovers into those areas to gain more evidence of these explosions. I haven't heard what the evidence is or what the reaction has been from the scientific community, but if this is a respected physicist, they can't really poo-poo what he is talking about. So take a look at that. The other thing I wanted to bring up is we had a one of members posts of the Cydonia region, and he has found quite an interesting figure, which appears to be, when he outlines it, it appears to be an alien figure that I have not seen before. People will focus on the Cydonia region and other areas of Mars and kind of reveal different types of features, structures. We know Mike Barra, the author of Ancient Aliens on Mars 1 and 2, the two books, has revealed and detailed the remains of actual structures, very large ones. And it appears that the race of beings who built these structures did so with an eye towards viewing them from outer space and high above the surface. So some of these structures are shaped like eyes. Some of them are shaped like pyramids and other landforms that are quite interesting. But this is this giant lion is something I've never seen before. And the individual who posted them actually asked the various features, which are quite curious to land. It's a beautifully rendered lion, quite large, hundreds of miles in diameter. Might even be, it's just very, many, many hundreds of miles in diameter. And I have given the viewer, when you go to see it, which is I've circled the famous face on Mars, and that is kind of the place to start. The interesting thing about this gigantic lion is that it is looking down at the face, which I find just very intriguing. So, as always, I suggest that you take a look at Earth's on Facebook and see what's being posted. We not only do I post information on there, but we have a lot of other people that post regular updates, regular news articles, and compelling evidence of ancient civilizations, not only on Earth but on other planets. So, I've always had a fascination with Atlantis, and have read quite a bit. The most well-known chronicler of Atlantis, but in the modern age, there was a well-respected psychic seer, Casey, who wrote a great deal about not only the land known as Atlantis, but how the individuals who lived in Atlantis survived, the kind of work they did, and in some cases, their perception of their lifestyle, which a lot of people don't take seriously, but as you read his work, it's quite accurate. in many ways. Well, I can't say it's accurate. It seems to be accurate because the level of detail is fascinating. My guest today, Frank Joseph, we've had him on the show before. And Frank, in my estimation, is one of the top chroniclers of Atlantis, and some of the places, people that lived in Atlantis repopulated after the final destruction. His is called Atlantis and the Coming Ice Age, the Lost Civilization Mirror of Our World. And I just got a copy about a week ago, and I think it's one of his best works. To quote the editor's overview of the book is drawing from the latest climatology studies and papers from the Pentagon and NASA analysts. Frank reveals that we are on the brink of a destructive phase in the global cycle of change as predicted by the Atlanteans and the Maya. The world's current political, economical deterioration is paralleled by unprecedented storms and record temperatures, massive solar flares, disturbances, and fusions, seafloors that could dangerous reservoirs of methane to the environment, all of which signals we are headed into another ice age. Frank Joseph is the editor-in-chief of Ancient American Magazine from 1993 to 2000. As I mentioned, he's the author of several books on Atlantis and also Civilizations of Prehistoric America and Before Atlantis. And we're bringing him on today because this book, I think, is very, very important. He provides us with some insight, not only on Atlanteans, but on the people that turned or actually evolved from the Atlanteans, which is the Maya, a fascinating group of people that I've studied for many, many years. Frank, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me back, and I want to especially thank you for mentioning Dr. Brandenburg. His work, I think, is among the most outstanding and the most shocking discoveries that have been made in all human history. And that is, that's not an overstatement. I'd like to see very much that report you mentioned. I'm familiar with his latest book called Death on Mars. And I don't want to go into it too much. It's not for me to talk about his book. I did interview him at some length last year, and I think he makes an absolutely compelling case for the destruction of Mars, which was inhabited by a race of intelligent beings that created a high culture. And it's not theoretical. It's gone beyond theoretical. The evidence that he has, the nuclear trace elements, the signature on the face of surface of Mars, was actually noticed by other physicists before him. He has had some high-ranking physicists older than himself that have verified his reports, but they don't have the courage to come out as he does and talk about it openly. And what he says is that Mars had this high culture millions of years ago, many millions of years ago. That in itself is mind-boggling, and that another culture came in from some other world and utterly destroyed that civilization, and the signature is clear. That's really what it boils down to, is that this trace signature is not caused by some natural event. There are natural nuclear explosions in space. This one is, though, has every earmark of being artificially detonated. And that, I think, is among the most mind-blowing and troubling, actually, revelations that have ever been made. But it's his arguments are faultless. It's not like somebody just saying, "Oh, I channel this," or this is a theory. It really happened. And that's something that's really hard to wrap one's mind around.
I think it's fascinating that here is a practicing physicist that is coming out with this information, and it's trickling into the news media, but it's not really something that you see NASA or even the European Space Agency that has rovers on the planet Mars or satellites circling Mars are commenting on, which makes me wonder. And by the way, I mentioned this before, we have a photograph from Dr. Brandenburg that actually, that both the Opportunity rover and the other Curiosity were very, very close to these detonation points,
mm-hmm.
which I find curious is that why they would be so close.
Well, they're investigating
so,
it. But we have to understand that neither the news media nor the government or NASA, if you want to put it, will ever, ever discuss these things or admit them. Never. And the reason why is they believe it is too socially dislocating. In other words, that if this information became part and parcel of everybody's understanding, it would overturn religions, so they think, not necessarily, it would overturn religions, it would cause a lot of, just a lot of social upheaval. That's what they're afraid of. And that's why the whole thing about UFOs, even the possibility of life on other worlds, is either ignored or ridiculed, because it is too dangerous to society. And maybe they're right. I don't know. I don't know human nature mm-hmm. maybe as well as they do. And that's why if you had a flying saucer land on the White House lawn and they came out and talked to Obama or zapped him or whatever they did, we'd never hear about it. Or else it would be couched in such language that we'd never know about it, because they are our caretakers, you know, the system, and they are not going to allow that information out unless they are absolutely forced to. I don't know what would compel them to, but they will never release that information. That's why they've kept a lid on it, or tried to, all these decades.
Yeah.
Well,
it's
I don't want to talk all about that, but I just was really taken by your willingness to come out and seriously discuss Dr. Brandenburg, who is not only a respected physicist, he's one of the most respected physicists. I mean, this man is really in demand. So it's not like, somebody that doesn't know what he's talking about. And after interviewing him, and that was, I think that was one of the life-changing moments of my life, because I didn't really believe in that. I thought that was just too preposterous. I couldn't accept such a thing. But after having interviewed him and read his work, I'm utterly convinced. And it upset me, I have to tell you. I mean, to think that millions of years ago there were these two high cultures, and one of these cultures was high enough that it could go from planet to planet or galaxy to galaxy millions of years ago. And inflict a nuclear holocaust on our neighbor, our next nearest neighbor. I mean, what else is out there, you know? We better behave.
Well, I'm looking forward to having him on the program. So
absolutely. That's got to be just top.
Yeah. Well, listen, this book, Atlantis and the Coming Ice Age, is a fantastic look, not only your research is, as always, very thorough on what you've discovered about Atlantis. But though the areas that were populated by an Atlantis culture, which eventually morphed into what I believe were the Maya, and then you kind of support that, my feeling about that. But let's talk about this book. You open, and if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about what we know about Atlantis from Plato's point of view. What was Atlantis all about, and what kind of a culture were they? Why don't you give us a little overview as we start?
Okay, well, first we have to understand that Plato did not invent this story. That had been known long before him. He had talks about it himself and his two dialogues, the Critias and the Timaeus, how he got it from Solon. And Solon was one of the top guys in ancient Greece. He was the first lawgiver in Western history, and he had gone to Egypt where he learned the story. That's how Plato picked it up, directly from Solon. It's about 600 BC. Plato wrote about 150 or 180 years later. There are many other references to Atlantis and many different cultures, as well as Greece, that go long back before Plato. But Plato's story is the most valuable because it is the most complete. As probably most of our listeners know, very few of the records from the ancient world, especially the pre-Roman world, still exist in their entirety. You know, time and religious wars and so forth destroy so much material. And Plato's is mostly intact. We don't have all of it. We have a description of it all the way up to the point of destruction. And when that is about to take place, Plato's narrative is lost. But what he tells us about Atlantis is that it was not a continent. Let's get that straight first. That's something that is, that's a misconception that's developed over time. It was not a continent. There's no evidence of a lost continent on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. The seafloor of the Atlantic is not strong enough to support a continent. However, there are many large islands across the Atlantic Ocean, most of them beneath the surface of the sea. And that's what Plato says Atlantis was located on, a large island off the coast of Gibraltar. He describes it as being just beyond the Pillars of Hercules, which is the Greek reference for the Straits of Gibraltar. And he described it as a large island. Now, the island itself, we're not entirely sure what the name of it was. Atlantis refers to the name of the city. The name of the island was most likely Atlas. And our listeners are probably familiar with that conception of a mythical figure supporting the sphere of the heavens or the zodiac, sometimes another misconception supporting the world. He's not holding up the world, he's holding up the zodiac. And Atlas was probably the name of this island. The name Atlantis means daughter of Atlas. In Greek, it's Atlantikos, and that means the daughter of Atlas, which makes sense because that's the city. And this city was very unusual. It was totally un-Greek, so it's not like something Plato could have just thought up. It was, if you were to see it from the air, it would resemble a target. It was made of alternating rings of land and water. These rings of water served as moats. It was a very large city. It had a very large canal that went from three harbors on the southern coast of the island of Atlas, and this canal led directly, penetrated into the center of the city itself. The outer ring of Atlantis was used as a public gathering area. Anybody had access to a lot of trade and commerce went on there. The next, a bridge would go over the moat or the water ring to the next land ring, and there would be located another public area, only this was for ceremonies, with a lot of beautiful religious architecture, temples and so forth. The next nearest land ring would have been composed of the mansions and the estates of the movers and shakers of Atlantis, the generals, the priests, and so forth. And the center island, which was the smallest, was the residence exclusively of the royal family, the imperial family, the emperor and his wife and children. And there was a lot of great description of what this central island was like. It had a winery, and it had two very sacred, the most sacred areas. One was the great temple of Poseidon. And even though this great huge temple was centered on the island, which was the royal residence, it was open to public activities from time to time. For the ordinary person, in ceremonial occasions, was allowed inside. And at the very center of the city, in the very center of this small island, was a small grove. It's just a little hill and no temple, and it was surrounded by a wall of gold, not solid gold, but plated gold. And this also was open to the public on occasions. And this whole idea of sacred areas being open to the public, even in land owned by the imperial family, is very un-Greek. So everything that Plato is telling us about this place seems to indicate really a foreign place. He'd be hard taxed to invent all this. And that Central Grove area, which just had this little hill, was the sacred place where supposedly, in the religion or the spiritual traditions of the Atlanteans, the god Poseidon married a native woman. Her name was Clito. And from their union came the royal lineage of Atlantis, the Atlanteans themselves. And this is an interesting story because it would appear that what it represents is Poseidon was, of course, the sea god and the god of the sea. And he's described in this story as coming across the sea to marry this local woman and produce these children. And that's been interpreted, and I think rather credibly, as representing some foreign people long ago who came across the sea, or sea worshippers, as it were, sea god worshippers, and they landed on this island of Atlas, and they had children by local people. And that seems what the, in other words, it's a metaphor for a migration that took place probably from Western Europe. So the Atlanteans have always been rather hybrid people. They've always been crossbred with these influences from outside rather than just being some insular people that are entirely their own. So
okay,
it was a magnificent place. It, according to Plato and Casey and others, other traditions, that the Atlanteans began as a very virtuous people. This doesn't mean that they were a religious community at all, but it means that their spiritual idea was based on a wonderful principle. And that simple principle was that God or the gods make known their will to man through natural law. And accordingly, if you as an individual or a society follows natural law, you are ipso facto following the laws and the will of the gods. And based on this idea of a nature-oriented society, the Atlanteans prospered terrifically, economically, culturally, and were the first modern civilization. That's why Atlantis is important to us, one reason why. The first modern civilization. There were civilizations, I believe, before, or attempts at civilization, serious attempts at civilization before Atlantis. But Atlantis is the first civilization that looks like ours. In other words, they had standard weights and measures. They had a military. They had a regular form of government. They had the economic situation, barter and trade and so forth. They created an empire. All those things that are characteristic of modern civilization from them that seem to have been invented or coalesced in Atlantis itself. And that's why, that's one reason why it's an interesting place. So here you had this beautiful city, an unusual city, circular city, made of these concentric alternating lines of land and water on the south end of the island of Atlantis. The island itself was mostly taken up with farming. The interior of the island was incredibly fertile, according to Plato. That fits, because that area of the world, with all its volcanic activity, produces volcanic soil, which is the most fertile island in the world. So here was this large island, about maybe the size, not quite as, maybe about half the size or a little bit more, half the size of Portugal, say. So it was a good size island. It was a circular island. It was surrounded, it was ringed by a range of mountains, high mountains, except on the south end, which allowed for the city to be built. In the interior, the mountain was mostly given over to agriculture. So it was just a great place. It would have been wonderful to visit. We know a lot about it. We know that the high walls that, for example, that separated each one of these land rings was made of different colored stone. It was decorated with great sheets of precious metals. The Temple of Poseidon itself was a magnificent structure. It was over 100 feet high. It was about 600 feet long. It had a magnificent statue of the sea god at the far end of the temple. Poseidon was portrayed as standing in his chariot. And it was being pulled by six winged horses. At the base of the statue was 100 Nereids. These are sort of androgynous figures, somewhat female figures, riding on the backs of dolphins. A dolphin was an important symbol in Atlantis. So it was just a terrific place. A really beautiful, open air, kind of pre-Greek and non-Greek at the same time. So it's, I would say that the closest resemblance we might have physically to any of our listeners are familiar with this other culture were the Etruscans. The Etruscans were a people that settled in western Italy, and Plato says that their ancestors were directly Atlantean. And if you look at early Etruscan culture, this is probably the closest to what the Atlantean culture looked like.
Okay. So throughout the book, discuss Atlantean scientific prowess. Now, and you also crystal energy, which is piezoelectric energy. Now, how Atlantis must have been old culture, because to develop a science around piezoelectric energy takes time. So how old was Atlantis at the time of its destruction? Is it significantly old, or was it a group of other continents coming together together create a science? Tell us a little bit about the science, because that's a very important area in your book, because it's passed down to the Maya, who created these amazing calendars. But just show
yes, it is. Those are very interesting questions, of course. To answer the first part of it, how old was Atlantis? It looks as though that the culture of Atlantis, the indigenous culture of Atlantis, went back tens of thousands of years, very, very old. We have to understand that this was a rather relatively low-level culture, but nonetheless, the island of Atlantis appears to have been inhabited for a very, very long time. I go over that in my other book called Before Atlantis. However, the beginning of their what we call civilization, or their modern high culture, seems to have started about 3,800 BC. In other words, about 6,000 years ago. That seems to be the real beginning. And now this is, I understand that there are some people that have some strong objections to this chronology that I'm bringing out. I can understand their objections, but this is just the way it seems to me. I'm not insisting this that everybody believe this necessarily. We're sort of discussing all this, the possibilities. But it seems to me that the earliest that I can trace back the beginning of Atlantean civilization, like ours, modern one, would be about 3,800 BC, and it was finally destroyed by a huge natural catastrophe, which we know took place, which we know ravaged the Northern Hemisphere, and that happened exactly in November 1198 BC. So, yes, it was an old culture. It was continuous. It was interrupted by some wars. It was interrupted by other natural catastrophes, which survived from about 4,000 BC to about 1,200 BC. That's a long time to develop things. And did they have a high technology? There's no doubt that they did. The question is, how far did that high technology go? Not even Edgar Cayce can tell us how far it went. We know from hard facts that the Atlanteans were here in North America. And when they were here, they applied a kind of technology which we do not have today, and that is the Atlanteans were obsessed at the end of their time with mining high-grade copper. The highest-grade copper in the world is in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and around 3000 BC, somebody who possessed an incredibly high culture created a mining enterprise that has not been equal to this day. Something like half to three-quarters of a billion pounds of the world's highest-grade copper were excavated in the Kewanee Peninsula of Upper Michigan. And one of the ways that they excavated, I mean, that fact alone, we talk about a mining enterprise. How did they do that? A lot of their pit mines survive. You can go to a place called Isle Royale in Lake Superior, and you can see for yourself these ancient Atlantean pit mines. And some of them go down more than 60 feet through solid rock. Now, how is it possible that if we're to believe mainstream science, that indigenous people who had not even invented the bow and arrow at that time were able to excavate thousands of these pit mines that go down through solid rock? And more amazingly than that, I mean, that indicates a technology which is like way beyond anything Native Americans had at that time. The other thing which is amazing is, how did these ancient copper miners know exactly, precisely, where all the copper veins were? Sometimes the copper veins will extrude through the surface, and you can follow, you can see the copper on the surface, you can follow it down that way. That's not most of them, though. And yet each one of these 5,000 bit mines were right on the money. They knew exactly where the subterranean copper veins were. Now, that's a technology we don't have today. We have metal detectors, but they can't always go down more than 60 feet. And they certainly didn't have metal detectors back then, supposedly. That's an indication of the Atlantean technology. Now, that's hard evidence. That really, that's not something to be theorized about. We know that they had some kind of highly superior mining equipment for excavating and for finding that copper. Now, Edgar Cayce takes that further. Edgar Cayce, the reason I wanted to include him is, here's a man who was really not, you wouldn't even call him a particularly intelligent man. I would call him a simple man. He was a very nice man, an honest man. He was not a fraud. There's nothing in his life that indicates wanting to swindle anybody. Matter of fact, he never even had much money, even after the Institute was made. He doesn't fit the profile of a hoaxer in the least. Beyond that, some of his other predictions, I can't have time to go in, or have been, many of his other predictions have been verified, both scientifically and historically. Just terrific stuff. So that's why I included him. Of course, I'm faulted for that, saying, oh, your book is fine, but, oh, then you bring in this psychic and that wrecks the whole thing. Well, the truth is the truth, and if people don't like it, well, there's nothing to do about it. And Plato gives us a straight historical account of Atlantis. And it's very interesting, it's very valuable, of course. What Cayce does is that he puts a human face on it, and he talks about specific people, what happened to them, what their beliefs were, and what was going on a, from a human point of view in Atlantis in its last days. And amongst all that really credible information, he talks about their high technology. And he takes the technology beyond anything that we know historically. And so people say, oh, how can we believe they had flying machines and all this other stuff? Well, look at all the high machinery that was made to make the Great Pyramid. We know that they had tremendous machines to build that. Do any of them exist? No, because that's not the machinery is disposable. You know, you're making one specific thing to endure over time, but you don't save the well, like, for example, if you made the Sears Tower, nobody's anxious to save the derricks and all the shovels and everything that were made for that. That's all disposable stuff. And especially over the course of thousands of years, none of those tools are going to survive. So we have really no problem with that. And what Cayce did is he told us that the Atlanteans had some really high-tech material, and amongst it was the most important high-tech instruments that they had was their crystal technology. Well, that's not hard to believe either. What is our civilization based on? You ever hear of Silicon Valley? I mean, our whole electronic technology is crystal-based. And it's the same thing, I think, of the Atlantis. The Atlantis is really no different than ourselves. People were no smarter or dumber 10,000 years ago than they are today. And given enough time, human beings can do the same things. It's I don't even bother to argue these points with people anymore, you know. It's so self-evident if they just open their minds to it. And so the Atlanteans...
But you actually give a really good reference to Atlantean technology, and that would be the Maya, who were handed down this information, had levels of knowledge that must have been handed down to them. As an example that you give in the calendars and also in the astronomy, they had celestial mechanics that are mind-blowing, that are so sophisticated they could see the gravitation of a planet. I mean, there must have been somebody that handed this down to them, and we know it from the few books, the few codices that are left to us. But I've had other people on the program, engineers, who basically said that there were hundreds, if not thousands, of references that the codices were taken from. The codices are just the last drop of information handed down to the Maya that were probably, and you actually show this in the book, that were originated from the Atlanteans. And so that society that had sophisticated technology, perhaps even or ships that went to these other planets and studied their gravitational field and other motions.
It is amazing, isn't it? I mean, to think that the Maya were able to find out exactly the position of Venus in relationship to other stars and planets a million years ahead of time. I mean, what?
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that is just mind-blowing. But at the same time, the Maya themselves said that this information was given to them by their predecessors. Now, this does not denigrate the Maya at all, because to be handed this type of very high knowledge, you had to be pretty competent yourself to be able to understand it. The Maya did not just preserve this information, they built upon it. So what we refer to as the Mayan calendar doesn't really exist. Now, it's the Mesoamerican calendar. There were numerous cultures in ancient Mexico. The Maya were one of them. They were among the highest, of course. Before them were a people known as the Olmec. There were many people after them, like the Aztecs and the Zapotecs and the Toltecs and so forth, and all of them had this calendar. It was handed from one to the other. They preserved it, they built upon it, and but they all talked about how this original information was given to them by their predecessors who came from across the sea. The Maya story of the origin of the calendar is beautifully preserved, not in the codices, which are mostly incomplete, of course, because the priests burned most of them, but it's preserved in a book called the Popol Vuh. The Popol Vuh, or means the Book of Council, was written by Guatemalan Maya right at the end of their culture, and that's perfectly preserved. That's been translated. And it talks about how the Mayan calendar and how the Mayan technology arrived. And that was from somebody called Kukulkan. Kukulkan is the feathered serpent. That's another concept that was worshipped in all, revered in all of the other Mesoamerican cultures. And this feathered serpent, Kukulkan, is described in the Book of Council, the Maya Book of Council, as having resided originally on an island across the Atlantic Ocean, which they refer to as the Sunrise Sea. And the name of this island is called Patutlan. It sounds like a phonetic, a Maya version of Atlantis. And on this island was very high technology, high magic, they refer to it, and it suffered a natural catastrophe. It does not say anything more about it. It says it suffered a natural catastrophe and was destroyed. And Kukulkan, his family, his followers, and a number of quote-unquote sorcerers left Patutlan before it was finally destroyed and arrived on the coast of Yucatan. And when they arrived, they did not seek to conquer the native people, but rather to share their magic with them. And the Book of Council describes how Maya civilization is a form that developed between the contact between the these newcomers and the indigenous peoples. So, I mean, that's a pretty straightforward explanation. It sounds like what we're talking about is the destruction of Atlantis, in which survivors went to different parts of the world and shared their technology with native peoples to produce these hybrid civilizations. And I think that's exactly what happened.
Okay. So let's talk about these calendars, because this is a basis of your book. These predictive calendars, what they maybe how they were created. We talked a little bit about that, studying the planets, studying the cycles of our own planet Earth, and their ability to predict. Of course, the biggest Mayan date that we've all recently experienced is the end of the calendar cycle of 2012. So tell us a little bit about what you discovered.
Well, just a couple of basic things. First of all, it's not a calendar in the sense like something you hang on your wall and you tick off dates. What it really is a kind of an almanac, like a farmer's almanac, which follows cycles of nature and tries to make predictive statements about these things. So that's what we're talking about, is a kind of an almanac. And then to get it in our mind's eye, most of our listeners are probably familiar with an object known as the Aztec calendar stone. It's this huge disc which has all this really bizarre, beautiful imagery on it. And it originally was found by sewer workers in Mexico City in the early 19th century, and it's now in the Great Museum in Mexico City. And what the Aztec calendar stone is the concretization or the materialization of the Mayan calendar, the so-called Mayan calendar, the Maya almanac. It is the physical representation of and the culmination of all of the calendrical genius that was put into this concept from before the Maya. The Maya had the same thing. The calendar itself is based on four global catastrophes. If you know basically what the Aztec calendar stone looks like, or you have a picture of it, at the very center of it is this terrible figure of a man with his tongue sticking out, and on his tongue are human hearts. His eyes are bulging. And around this figure are four boxes. And in these boxes are representations of these four global catastrophes. And I won't go through all of them, but the most recent one is four awful. Four represents the four cardinal directions. That signifies the global nature of this catastrophe. And awful represents water. So they're referring to this great flood from which Kukul Khan and his family and followers arrived. And that flood took place in the year 3114 B.C., which is terrific because that is a period of major climate change that took place all across the Northern Hemisphere and all kinds of natural disasters, which we know did take place at that time. The calendar is based on these four natural catastrophes because that's something that everybody was familiar with. Oh, yeah, we knew when that terrible thing happened before the Great Flood, thousands of years before, was what they refer to as the fire from heaven, which appears to be a kind of a close comet call or meteor event or an asteroid event of some kind, and that the cycles of time were viewed by the Maya and their predecessors as being part times of destruction and renewal, and destruction and renewal over and over again. History was not seen as some linear progression, but in a cyclical pattern. What the Maya calendar says is that by 2012, which would be equivalent to their period of time, which is for Akun, by that time, human beings would understand that there was a definite relationship between their own behavior and the condition of the planet. And that's really interesting, because the basis of this calendar was that there's no way that you can separate human behavior as a society from natural phenomena. They believed that things like these global disasters were linked directly to human behavior. That natural law that I referred to earlier as the basis for their spiritual concepts was based on the idea that human beings are inextricably linked with the natural forces of life. In other words, that if you are obeying the laws of life, if you're obeying natural law, everything is fine. But that the moment that you stray from natural law and you contravene it, then nature is upset. There's an imbalance in nature, and we have natural catastrophes that wipe out civilization. That's basically the concept. That's an extremely modern idea, because now we understand that the very presence of a scientist will influence the outcome of a scientific experiment. We now understand that. We now understand that it's possible, as many people believe, that human impact on our Earth is causing major ecological problems. This is all predicted. All this was predicted by the Maya, who said that by the beginning of the 21st century, people would be aware of these things. 2012 was important to them because they said, this is the idea behind the so-called Maya prediction, that if by 2012 human beings had understood that they had contravened natural law and made an effort to go back to following natural law, that any kind of catastrophe would be avoided. However, if they continued to defy natural law and to live self-indulgently without any concern for natural concerns, that civilization would be doomed. That's all they said. Now, they didn't say that the world would end or that this natural catastrophe would take place in 2012. They defined 2012 as a kind of a barrier, that if we had gotten our acts together before 2012, that we could expect to prosper and go on being the way we have. But if we had not reversed the consequences of what we were doing by 2012, that our civilization would continue into decline until it was destroyed. So it still is up in the air whether did we in fact get our act together? Did our environmental laws indicate that we were on our way to becoming a naturally oriented civilization again? Or have we gone on and continued to act against the laws of nature? This isn't only just pollution. It's an entire way of being, an entire social dislocation. The Maya believe that human energy interfaced with natural energy, that they are not compartmentalized. They're all part of the same thing, and that an imbalance in one part of the cosmos causes consequences in another part of the cosmos. So 2012 was regarded as a kind of a barrier. Do I make myself clear on this? It's described in far greater detail in the book than I can compress in
a few words here. The 2012 is a good starting point because our listeners probably, and the whole world, of course, knows about that and the dire predictions and how the religious factions built on that and made it a doom and gloom. And I think some people even committed suicide during that period because they thought the Earth was going to end. So it's a good starting point. Now, you have a chapter in the book that I want to talk a little bit about some of these predictions, these cycles, as you call them. You have a chapter called "The Rebellion of Earth," and you start discussing some of the phases that we may be going into. Can you talk a little bit about that? I think it's chapter 7, the rebellion of the Earth, which is interesting.
Well, interestingly enough, that concept called the rebellion of the Earth, that is how the Maya referred to 2012. That's the translation of how they referred to this period of transition. They said that when the early missionaries in the 16th century were asking the Maya high priests about these cycles, they said, well, you had these four previous destructions of the earth by the fire from heaven and the flood and so forth, and what's the next destruction if human beings don't get their act together? And the Maya priests responded by saying that would be a rebellion of the earth. It was assumed that would be an earthquake, but it does not seem to be. It seems to refer mostly to an ecological upheaval of some kind. So I think it's pretty interesting. When I learned about this, I first began studying the so-called Maya prophecy or the Maya calendar back in 1986. I was doing some research work in Mexico at Yucatan at that time, and I got a chance to meet some of the Maya elders who told me about the Maya calendar, which I'd not heard of at that time. The Maya calendar only began to get press really in this century. And I was familiar with the Aztec calendar stone to some extent, but they really informed me what it was all about. And it was really interesting that the Maya calendar itself that they told me about, I kind of lost my train of thought on this. It was to predict a natural catastrophe. I got my head together on this again. Sorry about that. The natural catastrophe which the Maya talked about, they were nonspecific, but they did say that it would be a natural global catastrophe that would happen again, this rebellion of the earth, that would be caused at least in part by human input. So I became fascinated by this. Well, what possible specifics are we looking at here? You know, what are the chances of a global catastrophe wiping us out again, and especially if man would be involved? And so I looked at things like meteor collisions and all that, and none of that really fit too well, especially because men wouldn't have any input. But I did find something. I did find actually about four possibilities that could really destroy our civilization and wipe out most of life on Earth again, in which we would play a role. And the two that were most compelling are the coming of another ice age, or renewal, actually, of the ice age. And one that's even more, which the book is named after, and one which is even more compelling, and that is our obsession with oil. And that is in this regard. At the bottom of the sea, underneath the bottom of the sea, are these enormous methane pockets, huge amounts of thousands of square miles of methane. And they're held in check by what is known as hydrates. And hydrates are like these great nets or networks of ice. It's very cold at the bottom of the ocean. And these huge deposits of methane have always been held in check down there. It's part of the very body of the Earth itself. The methane is produced over the course of many millions of years by organic material. I don't have to go into that. But nonetheless, science does know and has known for a long time that these enormous pockets of methane are held in check by this lattice work of this ice. It's ice cubes, if you want to put it that way. It's held at the bottom of the ocean. Well, 280 million years ago, it's a long time ago, something bad happened. In Siberia, a number of volcanic eruptions, a whole mountain range of volcanic eruptions took place and extruded huge amounts of lava into the sea. And that lava was so hot, and it was so much of it, that it went to the bottom of the sea and was still hot. And it burned away, it melted some of those lattice work that were holding the methane bubbles in check. And what happened was is that some of those methane bubbles burst. And they came to the top of the sea, and they produced the greatest natural catastrophe in all Earth's history. This is known as the Permian extinction, in which over 90% of all life on Earth was exterminated, was wiped out. When that methane hit the surface of the sea, not only produced this, it poisoned the air, but this poison was in the form of a low-lying gas. And when that gas hit the volcanoes that were exploding, the entire Earth was incinerated and poisoned. We know that this took place. This is the cause of the Great Permian extinction. A slightly smaller extinction took place many millions of years later. So it's happened twice. The extinction of the dinosaurs that happened 65 million years ago wiped out about 70%, not quite 70% of all life on Earth, which is pretty bad. But this one, this was over 90%. It's amazing that life was able to come back, but it did. Now, those methane bubbles are still down there. That's the way the Earth is made. And they're perfectly safe so long as they're held within check by those icy hydrates. But with all of the drilling that is taking place, all of the excavation for oil that is taking place in the sea, what is happening is now that the sea temperatures worldwide, the global ocean temperatures, are rising astronomically. That since the 1950s, the sea temperatures have risen significantly. I've documented in the book. None of this information is channeled or made up. I provide sources and footnotes for every statement that I make, that the sea levels, the sea temperatures are heating up. Now, it doesn't take much. It does not take much for the temperatures of the ocean to begin to melt those hydrates. And if we melt through our meddling, for our obsession, our hunger for oil, and that's, of course, where most of the oil comes from, it's from the bottom of the sea. If we melt those hydrates and one of those methane bubbles comes up, that's it. That's toast. And I mean only the end of humanity, but it's the end of a large amount of life on Earth. And there's absolutely nothing that anybody can ever do about that. We can talk about defending ourselves from an incoming asteroid or a meteorite sometime in the future, but once one of those gas bubbles bursts, That is it. That's the end. And that actually fits the prediction of the Maya, because the Maya said that human beings would have some kind of a hand in this self-destruction if we continue to abuse the nature that has brought us into existence. That nature will snap back at us in the worst possible way. And that possible scenario, which I go to in some detail in the book, that is entirely possible because we now know that the temperatures of the ocean are, in fact, heating up. That's really concerns me even more than the ice age, because ice ages are inevitable. There's nothing that we can do to stop it or to make it, although we can contribute to its speeding up and even to its worser aspects. So an ice age does fit the Maya scenario also, but more specifically, it's that possibility. That's another thing, of course, which is not discussed. You're not going to hear this on the mainstream media because it's too disturbing. If this information about these mega bubbles, these mega methane bubbles, was made, let's say, on the nightly news, they said, hey, you know, that Scott Pelley would get on and say that it's possible, more than possible, that all this oceanic drilling is heating the oceans up and we're going to spark one of these methane bubbles inevitably. What do you think would happen to the oil industry? It would be shut down. People would say, okay, we need oil, but we need to be alive first. The scenario would be bad. And say, well, you know, this Permian extinction over 90%, you know, was caused by one of these methane bubbles. Same thing that we're, that would be it. So it's not discussed. And that's the mindset of these power freaks that run the world, you know, like, well, the future will take care of it. Right now we need the money, the bottom line. Well, that's the
right.
They don't care that the world is destroyed so long as that they we'll figure out some technology that'll take care of it in the future, you know. But that is the most worrisome of them all.
Well, you actually bring up another point that I have heard about vaguely, and that is the solar storms that if they hit America, especially America with all of our technology, would be devastating. Will you talk a little bit about a super solar storm and why that is a terrible thing to happen to us?
It is very terrible. We have a hand in that also. The only claim for originality I make in my book, because my book is based on the hard work and the genius of so many other people, and I try to give them all credit, but I have to give myself a teeny little bit of credit here because I don't know that anybody else mentioned these solar storms before my book came out in 2012. They were known, the scientists knew about them, but the general public was unaware of them. Now people are becoming aware of them. Others have written about them and talked about them, so they're not that unfamiliar. And that is that the solar storms that take place, they're all related to what is known as sunspots. Well, spot sounds like a small thing, these little blemishes on the sun. Of course, the sun is 93 million miles away, and so they look like little dots on it, on the sun. Well, they're not little dots, they're storms. They're incredibly violent storms, and they're as big as the planet Jupiter. The small ones, the ones you can barely see, they're the size of Earth. But the sunspots are enormously powerful explosions on the sun, unthinkably powerful. Imagine an explosion that could wipe out the planet Earth or the planet Jupiter, no problem. And that goes on the sun all the time. And when these sunspots take place, when you have this sunspot activity, then the sun is really angry. You've got a lot of violence coming out, and it produces a tremendous amount of these, what they call photons, like from Star Trek, and when they photons and electrons, and when they interact with the magnetic sphere, the magnetic sphere of the Earth, they produce beautiful lights in the sky. You know, the northern lights, which is fine. It's the same thing like when the cathode tube lights up in the old television set. It produces these lights. Well, that's fine. But if one of these storms, these electromagnetic storms, happen to hit us in the wrong way, or the hit us directly on target rather than glancing off the atmosphere, or if it's strong enough, if it's powerful enough, it fries every electrical device on Earth. And that's what happened in 1859. The only electrical technology we had then were telegraph wires. In 1859, all of the telegraph wires across the entire United States and Western Europe were fried. They burst into flame in certain areas and just went down. So people tried to figure out what on earth happened. And they were all repaired. Nobody was hurt. But nonetheless, communication absolutely ceased. It was a very brilliant man, an Englishman by the name of Richard Carrington. Richard Carrington was a meteorological scientist. And he determined, through cause and effect, that this great destruction of the telegraph wires across North America and Europe took place by a solar storm. And the reason why he thought so was at the same time that this meltdown happened, the northern lights were the most brilliant they had been seen in many hundreds of years. The northern lights were seen as far south as Puerto Rico at that time. The northern lights are so bright you could almost read a newspaper by them. And so he made this correlation between the sun's capacity to create these enormous electromagnetic storms and the meltdown. And it's known then as a Carrington event, named after him, these great solar storms. The next one that took place was in the 1920s, early 1920s. It was nowhere near as big as the one that happened in the 19th century. And yet it caused some severe burnout in New York City, shut down the trains for a little while. The next big one that took place was in 1989. That was the blackout, the Quebec blackout. It knocked out the entire area of Canada. These were relatively small storms. If we had an electronic storm, electromagnetic storm, of the nature, the magnitude of the one that happened in the 19th century associated with Richard Carrington, it would completely disable civilization because our modern society is based entirely on electronics and computers. And it wouldn't make any difference if your computer is plugged in or not. It would fry everything. That would mean that elevators would stop, that the first people to die would probably be people in the airplanes because they fly by, they navigate by
GPS.
VHS and stuff like that. They'd be gone. The next people that would die would be diabetics because all of the refrigeration for their medical needs would go. So a Carrington event would be absolutely disastrous. Now, NASA has understood this, that a Carrington event is really serious. And so NASA, for years, tried to prevail upon the U.S. government for the funding necessary to put a satellite into space that would monitor the sun specifically for a Carrington event. Number one thing, to do research, but also to monitor the sun. And the U.S. government was very reluctant for a number of years, but they finally launched it in 2010, late 2010. And it's called the Solar Probe, and it's up there now, and it monitors the sun. So that is a somewhat of a preventative against such a thing. Trouble is, it doesn't stop a solar event. It just can sound the alarm. The setup is that if there is a major eruption on the sun, an EMP as they call it, the NASA will notify the White House directly on sort of a hotline. And it is up to the president then, whoever is president at that time, to shut down the electronic grid across the United States. That's going to be rough to do that, because that means that there will be no electronic connections. And it will save the most part of our basic services, although your computer will be finished. But if he shuts that down to an economy that's as fragile as ours, the implications would be really quite dire. If he does not shut it down, it's possible that our civilization would be just disconnected. So that is a real possibility. I mean, the sun has produced these electronic storms, not regularly, but often enough. And we now know that there were electronic storms, electromagnetic storms from the sun that were much larger than the one that took place in the 19th century. Some of these electronic storms travel at incredible speeds. Now, we don't know how fast they can go. It's now believed that if the Carrington event, the one that happened in the 1800s, would take place today, that it might be too fast for us to actually get the word out to the president to shut down. He's the only one that has the authority to shut down the grid. Our electronic grid is so interconnected today that if it was not shut down, there would be no electricity. It would take at least a year, possibly 5 years, to restore any kind of electrical power to the United States, to North America. Countries like Russia or China and Western Europe, they have no preventative of this kind. They will definitely go down, especially China will definitely go down. So these are possibilities that fit into the Maya prediction. I personally, the one that I favor is the methane bubble. I think that is because there you see a real hand at work of man meddling in the delicate balance of nature that could definitely result in consequences far more disastrous than anything associated with an EMP.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. The solar flare sounds like something out of a movie. It's so fantastic, but if it did happen, it would be just devastating, completely devastating.
It would. And Frank, if we didn't have an electronic-based society, all we would see would be the same thing that Carrington and his fellow Earthlings saw back in the 1850s. Now you see these very brilliant lights in the sky. But because of this interaction, this interface between the electronic pulse and the electric grid that we have, the planet would go dark. The planet would go dark.
I want to bring up a couple of points in your book, and one of them that really intrigued me, it's a chapter you call How Could They Have Possibly Known? And you're referring to the Maya and their predictions and their look into the future. And, of course, if you study the Maya, they have stelae, that standing stones that go deep into past history, very, very far in the back and in the past, and then they predict, you know, millions of years into the future, and it's just amazing. But you bring up an interesting point, which I have never ever thought about, and I think it's actually quite a good point: is could the Maya have used remote viewing in their predicting of the future and of the past? Can you talk a little bit about that? I think that's just a fantastic idea that no one has ever talked about.
Well, the reason that I included Edgar Cayce in this is because he really is right in line with the Maya, if that's in fact what they did. We have to understand that the Maya, exactly as you say, their great intelligence was able to range over time, from far back into the past, the deep ancient past, way into the far future. And there's really not any people that I can imagine that have done anything like that before, that had that kind of incredible vision, except individuals like Edgar Cayce. I believe that it's entirely possible that the Maya not only inherited this high science from a previous culture, which we call Atlantis, but I think that they also were able to combine their hard science with altered states of consciousness. We do know that the Maya were great users of mind-altering drugs, but they were not involved or even interested in recreational drugs, as we refer to it today. That these drugs were administered by high priests in such a way to help people to understand what was coming. The predictions that they made are, like I said, that one alone, where they understand the relationship of Venus to a particular star a million years from now. I don't care what kind of technology you have. How could you possibly accurately make a prediction like that without a supercomputer? We know they didn't have supercomputers, but we do know that they did have this mind. Altering experiences that they had. And similar to Edgar Cayce, Edgar Cayce's was entirely natural. And it's possible that they also engaged in something known as remote viewing, which is taken very seriously today by our military. The U.S. military studied remote viewing for something like 30 years. They officially shut it down, but when anything is officially done, you can be sure it's not being truthfully described. It's just as a cover. And no doubt that they are still involved in developing remote viewing. Remote viewing is through a process, self-discipline, where you can extend human consciousness to another area of the world or another area of the universe and to another area of time. And some remote viewers, like Inigo Swan, have been remarkably successful. They're not consistently successful, but they have nonetheless proved that remote viewing is a real phenomenon. And I think that the Maya were masters at this. I think we are just children. We're just early students of this. We're just beginning to recognize it. But the Maya, they were professionals in it. Their society lasted a lot longer than ours has, and they had more time to develop these things. And I think that they did develop them. And that the Maya calendar, I believe, is a synthesis of high science and high spirituality. They did not make the distinction between, as we do, between, oh, this is science and this is religion. I think that they melded them all together for tremendous results.
Interesting. I'm going to ask you a couple of quick questions because we're getting down to our time here. The first thing I want to ask you is, and I touched upon this earlier with the codices, the Mayan codices. Do you believe that the Atlanteans had the technology to actually travel to these planets and they created these, I would call them reference manuals or manuals on the celestial mechanics of each of these planets? Which was eventually passed on to the Maya, or do you think it was all observation?
Well, that is a wonderful question, and I think it relates to something we just discussed. I think it is entirely possible, because of this high information, that the Atlanteans were able to extend their consciousness to these other realms. I see no evidence whatsoever that they had the actual technology, that they had craft or whatever, although I have to say that that might be wrong after all, that there is some anecdotal evidence that they in fact did have craft that could fly, that they did have some kind of avionics. And how far they were able to go, I don't know. What I'm referring to specifically is something called the Vimana. And the Vimana was a flying craft somewhat similar to what we regard today as a flying saucer. I don't know how else to describe it. And it's the Vimanas, it's a Hindu word. It's described in quite a few, several written Puranas. The best book on the Vimanas is by David Hatcher Childress some years ago, and I think he's reissued it with an update. And that's an excellent book on the Vimanas, which talk about these Atlantean or pre-flood machines that could fly and go elsewhere. And if we were limited that only to ancient India, we would think, well, maybe it's a kind of science fiction. But the Hopi Indians had the same story. They talked about a pre-flood people, an Atlantean people, who had something called the Potawatomis. And the Potawatomis are described as these flying seeds. They were large seed-shaped craft that the pilots or whatever could go inside and fly to different places. And this is part of the Hopi Indian tradition. So it's possible that they did have this kind of technology. But beyond the story of the Hopi and the ancient Hindus, we don't have any solid evidence for that. I would prefer to think that the Atlanteans, like the Maya, who received this tradition from them, were able to extend their consciousness to various parts of the world. And I think that maybe that's the way that we will eventually be able to visit other planets, because some of these planets are so far away. I mean, we're talking about thousands of light years away. And we may have the technology to get there someday, we may not. But we may have the spiritual technology to get there. And I think that's entirely possible what the Atlanteans did.
That's a fantastic proposition idea. And in the final few minutes, Frank, tell us what you feel. Are we doomed to our current, because of our current state of mind, to destroy ourselves? Or is there hope? Is there hope for the future?
I do not believe that humanity is going to be destroyed. I believe that we are going to survive and go on to a tremendous future, a great golden, several golden ages. I'm absolutely convinced. I refuse to believe that there have been so many great human beings that have evolved over time and contributed so much that it was all for nothing. I don't believe that that is the way that that the cosmos works. However, I do believe that we're going to go through some extremely difficult times. I'm convinced that we're going to go through a downsizing and that it's going to be very difficult, either for us or for our immediate descendants. I don't believe that we can escape that. And I think that one way or another, one of the scenarios that I have postulated or something else that I don't know anything about is going to happen. I think that's inevitable. You cannot sin against history as much as we have and expect no consequences. But I think that our species has shown that we have gone through horrific catastrophes, man-made or not, in the past, that have brought us to the razor's edge of extinction, but we've always made it through. And I think that we're going to, that the destiny of the Earth is in man, and that I think that we're going to make it, but it's going to be rough. And I think that our present civilization is definitely going to vanish. It can't be fixed. It certainly is not going to go on. And it deserves what's going to happen to it. That's going to be rough. But I don't believe that human beings are going to be wiped out.
Interesting. The book is Atlantis and the Coming Ice Age. My guest today has been Frank Joseph. A wonderful conversation with you, Frank. I always ask my guests if they are going to be speaking anywhere that we can, the audience can hear you. We have, we're into our spring months, and then of course summer's coming up. Are you going to be anywhere that we can see you live or speaking in any programs that you want to talk about?
Yes, there's an Ancient Mysteries Conference coming up on May 16th, and that is going to be in Indiana, outside of Fort Wayne. It's at a small town called Grabe Hill, G-R-A-B-H-I-L-L. And for the specifics on that, you can contact me directly if you'd like. I think it's going to be posted on our website, which is www.ancientamerican.com. And if you, I don't know that that information has been posted there directly, but if you want to get in contact with me, there's a toll-free number. It's 877-494-0044. And whoever answers the phone there will be able to give you the information on the Grabe Hill, Indiana conference, which is coming up. It's kind of a symposium, not really a conference. And,
I'll make sure I post that link, that web link, to that page.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
I always want to do those things. The book, again, Atlantis and the Coming Ice Age, just came out in April. Oh, excuse me, it's going to be coming out in the next week or two, I guess. Is that the...
Well, no, it's actually, it's out now. It was released March 20th.
Okay, good. So I was just reading this form here. So you can get it on Amazon and I guess all the other areas. You can download it. Do you know if it's been, it's digital too, Frank? Is it a digital version that people can see, or is it just the hard copy? Do you know?
I think right now it's just the hard copy, but digital is probably in the works and should be available soon.
Okay, fantastic. I appreciate the information. Wonderful talk, Frank, and we look forward to more of your good work in the near future.
Well, it's very kind to have you on your show, and you ask these really insightful, intelligent questions, so we always have a great discussion, I feel.
Always fun, Frank. Much good luck and continued success to you.
And continued success to you as well. I'm looking forward to hearing your interview with Dr. Brandenburg.
That will be interesting. I'm looking forward
to it. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So that's our program today. Be sure to check on the Facebook page. I will have Frank Joseph's book there. I'm also going to take a couple of photographs that are in the book, and I post those just to give you a reference of what Frank has written. This is a very important book. Frank has written a very great piece. Again, the book, Atlantis and the Coming Ice Age, The Lost Civilization, A Mirror of Our World. That's it for today, and I look forward to talking with you next week.